Our commencement speaker today is a man who has dedicated his career to the service of this state. Thrice elected to the General Assembly and thrice elected governor of the state of Connecticut, former United States Senator and now Chief Justice of the state's Supreme Judicial Body. His career of public service to this state is unsurpassed. It was he who, while serving his first term as Chief Executive of the state 24 years ago, signed into law the bill that made this institution the University of Connecticut. Judge Baldwin, you are well aware that this university does not award formal honors at its commencement. But you should know that in extending to you an invitation to address this commencement in the year of your retirement from the bench, we intend to pay you the highest honor within our gift in recognition of your immeasurable contributions to this state and to this university. Ladies and gentlemen, I have the honor to present the Chief Justice of the state, the Honorable Raymond E. Baldwin.
Your Excellency Governor Dempsey, President Babbage, members of the faculty, members of the graduating class, and others who are here for honorary and other degrees, parents and friends of the graduates, ladies and gentlemen. I am deeply grateful for the high honor which you have accorded me by asking me to address this, the 80th commencement of this university. I shall always treasure the memories of this occasion, the beauty of the afternoon, the largeness of the crowd, even the temperature, I think I'll recall, and the wonderfully colorful academic procession, and the excellent music. It is indeed for me a memorable occasion. I well recall 24 years ago when in the governor's office I greeted a group from the university, and the clerk of bills brought in the engrossed copy of the charter which made this a university, and it was my rare privilege to sign it. And as I recall it, I signed it with a quill pen, probably the last document in Connecticut that was signed with a quill pen. I'm not sure, but I think the School of Agriculture produced that pen from some goose. Anyway, it worked pretty well, but you know there's been an aftermath to that. Today the question came up when it was mentioned as to who had the pen, and President Babbage and the provost of the college looked at me with some suspicion. And I want to assure you, gentlemen, that I didn't keep the pen. I gave it to Al Jorgensen. You will have to look him up for that. The inventive genius and creative ability of mankind has put all of the known forces of nature to work for him. You launch out into a world of advanced science and technology. But really, there's nothing entirely new about that. Other classes before you have faced a similar heritage challenge. The world of science and technology began with the ancients thousands of years ago. Perhaps it began as long ago as the time when man first discovered how to kindle a fire and to make it serve him. However, in these later years, the advance in both science and technology has gone forward at a fantastic rate. It would seem that we must have reached the ultimate. We haven't. It could be, however, that we have fashioned machines, and I use the word machines for want of a better generic term. We have fashioned machines that threaten to dominate our lives. We can feed cards into an automatic computer that will give us the answer to almost any question. But will it? I read a short time ago of two freshmen entering college who stated, each on his application card, his desire to room with a foreign student. After the cards had gone through the computer to compare each with a foreign student, the freshmen found that they were assigned a room with each other. I dare say that more scientific knowledge and skill went into the creation of capsule Faith 7, than any other of man's creations. Nevertheless, at the critical phase of re-entry, the automatic firing of the retrojets failed. Gordon Cooper, coached from Earth by John Glenn, brought his capsule back into Earth's atmosphere by manual operation. The point of these incidents is that the machine did not provide the answer. It was incomplete, insufficient to the entire human need. The truth is that a machine, no matter how perfectly devised, cannot solve all our problems, cannot meet every crisis, cannot make life complete. Behind all science and technology and their creations is the human element, man. God's creature, intelligent, capable of acquiring and using knowledge, possessed with the powers of choice and decision, and those moral and spiritual qualities which we define, albeit imperfectly, as character. What is character? Dwight Moody, the great evangelist of the 19th century, said, "Character is what you are in the dark." Character, said Frederick Saunders, is the governing element of life and is above genius. And that is very true. We have had many a genius who lacked moral and spiritual qualities which marked him as a great, forceful character. His accomplishments always fell short of his capabilities. We have had many men and women who possessed great moral and spiritual virtue, but were geniuses as well. They reached their goals. When we think of character, there comes to mind almost instinctively those homely virtues such as courage and honesty, loyalty, energy, initiative, faith. There's nothing new about them. Are they old-fashioned in this day when newness seems to encompass every virtue? Do they appear to have lost much of their glamour? Today we laugh at the Horatio Alger success stories of my youthful days. And I speak of, in this vein, principally because you will meet this attitude in others. And it is somewhat difficult for us to overcome it ourselves. Some folks, vociferous, but thank heaven limited in number, think that a man or a woman who possesses these virtues is, in the parlance of that group, a square. What a debasement of that grand old word. Time was when square was one of the most meaningful words in our language. A man spoke with pleasure of getting a square deal or a square meal, and people were proud to say that they stood four square for the right, that they had paid their debts and were square with the world, and that they could look the other fellow square in the eye. Are we afraid of being called a square if we do the right thing when we are required to make a choice according to the best dictates of our conscience? I would say not, in spite of the cynics and doubters about us. Are we ashamed or afraid to squarely meet a challenge? Just suppose that Nathan Hale, a young Continental soldier in Washington's army, was asked by his superior officers to go over from New York to Long Island and learn what he could about the British plans and operations. Just supposing Nathan Hale had said, "What, me? Bud, do you know what the British do to spies? They hang them. Let George go, but not me." Or suppose that Paul Revere, when asked to arouse the Minutemen in the back country of the enemy's advance, had said, "Whoa, chum, I'm not the only one in Boston that has a horse. Go down to the Common and get yourself a hackney." Or suppose that Clara Barton, when she was helping to relieve the suffering of wounded soldiers in the Civil War, had quit, saying, "Enough's enough. The glamour's worn off this job. Let some other gal who has more time found the American Cross. I'm long overdue at my hairdresser's." At 100 invasion beaches in the last war, thousands of our men looked death squarely in the eye and did not flinch. And within the vivid memory of all of us here today, our astronauts Shepard and Grissom, Glenn and Carpenter, Shira and Cooper, after months of intensive training and preparation to the minutest detail, sat strapped in their capsules atop a rocket, waiting to be blasted into space. Now just suppose that at that moment, or even before, they had said, "Hold on, fellas, this thing is going far enough. If you want to pull off this stunt, get yourself another monkey." These people of whom we have been speaking possessed in abundance those homely old virtues which we have learned at home, in school, in college, and in our religious training. These people accomplished great things because they possessed these virtues, because they were people of strong, positive, fearless character. Their course of action having been determined, they stuck to it. Had they flinched, had they been unwilling to be considered squares, many of the finest pages in our history would never have been written. Many of the blessings we enjoy would never have come into being. Much of our treasured heritage would have been lost. Well, we can't all be astronauts or soldiers or statesmen or patriots whose deeds and accomplishments distinguish us as heroes and benefactors of mankind. But all of us can live our lives and face the difficulties that life will bring as women and men of character, possessed of courage, honesty, loyalty, initiative, energy, and abiding faith. We can, as college men and women, show to the world those qualities of characters which will brand us as leaders, as pushers, and not as writers, as doers, and not as sitters. A recent survey of persons discharged from 76 large American employers showed that only 10% were dismissed for lack of the necessary know-how, while 90% were let go because of character defects. 20% of these failed in the required leadership ability, and 21% in initiative. Yes, women and men who have strong, honest, positive characters stand out among their fellows. They are the successful ones in life's adventure. When we speak of the place which character plays in the affairs of men, there is one phase of our space program which has received little attention, or I think much less than it deserves. We have been told of the scientific knowledge and technological skill employed in a space program that really defies our imaginations. Every science has been enlisted to provide the knowledge necessary to meet and master any eventuality in space flight. Our astronauts, scientists, technicians, manufacturers, and fabricators have collaborated in 6 major epic-making performances, which worked out perfectly, or as we say, on the nose, before the eyes of the world. The most vital factor in the whole affair, however, was this. 6 men had to take their places in their respective capsules, face the risk, be prepared to overcome any possible error, and meet fearlessly what, in spite of every elaborate preparation, was bound to be in large part unknown. They were selected for their skill as pilots, for their aeronautical engineering and scientific knowledge, for their physiques. Furthermore, each had to be a man with an explorer's curiosity to look beyond every horizon, a mountaineer's response to the challenge of height, ice, and snow, and the frontiersman's craving to move into new territory. But beyond all that, they had to be men of strong, positive natures, fearless, enthusiastic, calm, loyal. They had to be capable of unselfish devotion, possess unbounded faith in their own and their fellows' capabilities, and be confident of success. In short, they had to be men of character in the broadest, finest sense of that term. They proved that they were such men, and more than that, they were men of deep and abiding religious conviction. They were willing to accept whatever disposition divine providence might make of their venture. They were not ashamed to seek his help in prayer. And from their spacecrafts in the sky, they viewed with their own eyes God's creation as none of us have ever seen it. They saw that which the ancient psalmist envisioned when he wrote, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork." In every crisis in human affairs, men and women of great moral and spiritual worth emerge. The British historian Bryce wrote that if America had no other gift to make than the character of Washington, that would be a sufficient contribution. In these latter years, when new nations are coming into being, and Castro and Sukarno and Nkrumah and their like are selfishly imposing their so-called democratic regimes on their people, there comes to mind an incident in the life of George Washington, which demonstrates his character, his patriotism, and unselfish devotion to his country. When the Union of the States, under the Articles of Confederation, was proving to be a failure, Washington's most intimate friends and admirers urged that he take control, that he, in effect, establish a dynasty, a dictatorship, around which a government could be formed. He flatly refused, and out of this refusal, there ensued a series of conferences of representatives from the several states, first at Mount Vernon, then at Annapolis, and finally, as a result of the Annapolis meeting, a convention at Philadelphia, the convention that framed the Constitution of the United States. We can never know what might have been lost of all the great sacrifice of the Revolution, what might have been in store for our country, but for Washington's unselfish relinquishment of ambition, his true devotion to a great cause. We are the beneficiaries of his strong, positive character. How unfortunate and how dangerous it is that in these new nations coming into being, there are not men of Washington's character to provide unselfish, devoted leadership. You will go from here well prepared into many fields of endeavor, business, the professions, teaching, public life. Some of you will make your contribution to the sciences and technology, which seem to dominate this age. You will succeed, but you will succeed only if you prove yourselves to be women and men possessed of great moral and spiritual qualities. The old world and its tangled affairs needs women and men of great moral and spiritual strength.